The party's ready and present. Let me just mention the case is set for 1.5 hours, and both attorneys have to keep track of their time. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. I think this case involves...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Could you just state your name for the record? I should have mentioned that.
That's I pointed my finger to my name at the entrance, I thought.
It's okay.
Perfect to laugh, Your Honor. Dufford Brown appearing for the appellant. This case involves three components. Civil lawsuit for damages, a decision of the attorney's fund for client protection, and a sanctions order by the presiding disciplinary judge. I think there are two levels of focus that could be applicable to this case. And number one is the fairness and proper decision with respect to Mr. Mulvihill based on the unique facts of this case. From a policy point of view, which is the other...
Mr. Dura, can I just interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Sorry. I have a copy of the order entered by the presiding disciplinary judge, and it appears that you're... You withdrew at one time, and as well as the fact that Mr. Mulvihill defaulted.
That's correct.
And there was no appearance whatsoever at the PDJ hearing.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's correct statement.
So what's the basis for the appeal?
Well, the basis of the appeal is...
Procedurally. I understand your legal arguments.
Well, I think procedurally, Mr. Mulvihill is entitled to have a review before this court of the sanctions order entered by the judge. I mean, I don't...
Irrespective of not appearing and defaulting?
Yes, sir.
And what's the basis for that?
Well, the basis for that is that it's nothing more nor less than a factual determination by the presiding judge, disciplinary judge, and he entered an order. And just because someone defaults doesn't mean that they don't have a right of review. Certainly didn't let the time for appeal before this court expire.
Let me just follow up with that a little bit. Sort of a basic premise that you is necessary to preserve issues for review. How can it be said that anything was preserved for review if nothing was raised whatsoever because of a default?
Or
is that not a requirement in this kind of review?
I don't think that. Well, first of all, I think as a fundamental proposition of this court's function, whatever happens at the proceedings below is reviewed de novo by this court.
It's not appealed?
I'm sorry?
Well, we don't review them if they aren't appealed, right?
Well, unless I'm mistaken, we filed a notice of appeal in this court.
No, you did, but the question is whether you preserved any issues.
Well... the only issue that's being preserved is the appropriateness of the sanctions in this case and the entry of an order that said you could do one thing or do another. And
right. But see, ordinarily we would say, did you raise that below? And the other side would argue if it wasn't raised, whether whatever it was, there'd be an argument that it wasn't preserved. Well, here there wasn't anything raised below. So it seems to me either it wasn't preserved or there's no such requirement. Otherwise, you have a problem.
Well, I'm not sure that there's a requirement that someone stand up and say, I object to the entry of the sanctions because you did not, as a presiding disciplinary judge, consider the fact that you're trying to deal with three components of what's going on here. What you're dealing with is, as a presiding disciplinary judge, needs to take into consideration what happened in the state court and what was likely to happen with the attorney's fund, because coincidentally there was a letter the day before the entry of the sanctions order that said the fund is going to disperse $75,000. So it seems to me that the issues here aren't just what the presiding disciplinary judge did as a matter of sanctions.
Still, that the fund is clearly in the rules is clearly non-appealable, so that we certainly have no jurisdiction whatsoever over the actions of the fund. So that's not accurate with respect to whatever the PDJ says.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because that's kind of certainly an anomalous position in my view, because here we have a disciplinary judge who's entering sanctions, and his sanctions involve the fund. This court has the authority to deal with sanctions. And to say that part of the sanctions, because they're a matter of grace under the statute, aren't appealable, to me is a pretty anomalous position. I think that what we're talking about here is the policy decision of trying to encourage people in these kinds of situations to resolve disputes and put money in the pocket of the person who's been harmed and reach finality with respect to the person who's being sanctioned.
Well, I guess we're all coming at this from a different issue, so let me just take one more bite at it, if I may, sir. So I see that the client fund, attorney's fund, put in a statement of claim.
Yes, ma'am, he did.
And there were, I guess, on your part, no objections to that statement of claim. That might be another way of coming at it. Therefore, the claim was awarded, and the fees were, or the money was awarded. So there was a procedural posture, if you will, in the lower forum. Well, to which there was no objection.
No, that's, with all due respect, it's not quite accurate.
Okay, could you help me with that then?
Sure. If you look at the disciplinary counsel's brief, Exhibit 1, contains his report to the fund and Mr. Mulvihill's response to that report. And in the response, there was an argument that since there had already been a settlement, that additional distributions were not necessary. So there was.
Okay, I see that too, that attached as a copy to a brief is a response.
Yes, sir.
So you're standing on that as your action before the PDJ, which would give rise to the appeal today.
Well,
is that what we should be focusing on, the statement of claim and the response?
Partially. I think that from the position of Mr. Mulvihill, what he's looking for is finality. And then how does that interplay with the things that are the moving parts of the decision here?
Can I just ask you one question? Beg your pardon about interrupting. How did Mr. Mulvihill file this? You didn't file this on his behalf. This was like a pro se document, or because you had withdrawn at that point?
No.
You were in at that point.
With respect to the fund, we filed it as
okay.
His counsel.
Thank you.
Because there was no issue that Mr. Mulvihill wanted to raise, because he's 75 years old, with respect to the issues before the disciplinary judge, we did not want to incur the fees simply on his behalf to show up and say, we disagree with what you're going to do. There was a prior discussion between myself and regulatory counsel about what was going on in the state court. And so it wasn't that we were an unknown commodity, so to speak. But it seems to me that what happened was Mr. Mulvihill gets a letter from regulatory counsel, Mr. Gleason, and the letter says there's been a claim made against the fund. Mr. Mulvihill did not get a copy of the claim fund form, which at the bottom assigns to the fund Mr. Mulvihill any claims against Mr. Mulvihill. Mr. Mulvihill then goes through the state court process and settles the lawsuit with Mr. Pearson. Mr. Pearson dismisses all of his claims with prejudice against Mr. Mulvihill. Now, you know, it's kind of like a catch-22. It seems to me what ought to be the policy of this court and the Attorney's Fund for Client Protection and the disciplinary judge's role is to harmonize so that there's one settlement, one resolution, once and for all.
What about the policy of restitution to the victim? And don't we have a responsibility to govern the legal profession to see that the victims are made whole for defalcations?
Absolutely.
So why isn't that totally independent of any settlement that's of a civil lawsuit from a policy standpoint?
Well, because I think this court in the past has and should consider parallel proceedings with respect to what's going on in a given factual situation, instead of leaving loose ends hanging out. The people who represented the fund, the lawyers, knew that there was a state court proceeding. The form assigning claims to the fund.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of discipline is separate and apart from a civil lawsuit, isn't that right? Just generally, in terms of principles, would you agree with that?
Certainly.
And don't lawyers have a responsibility to not just to settle lawsuits when they're involved, but also to obey the rules of professional conduct? And your client severely disobeyed the rules of professional conduct, didn't he?
The disbarment issue isn't...
It isn't just disbarment. It had a victim that was out $150,000 plus interest, right?
And Mr. Martin will try to resolve that before...
Well, that's good. That's involved in the civil litigation. You do civil litigation, don't you? There are lots of reasons for settling cases, aren't there? That have nothing whatsoever to do with the responsibility of the lawyers standing up to their profession, do they?
Well, if you want to talk about the universal possibilities, that's true.
And it's not universal possibility. It's responsibility that each and every one of us has to obey the oath, to be honest to our clients, and not steal their money.
Well, this court's making an assumption that Mr. Mulvihill was doing something other than trying to resolve a dispute on a basis that put money back in the pocket of the person who had suffered the damage.
Applehood.
Did the best he could.
Well,
I'm
sorry, but it seems to me this is still tied into his default. Sanctions are part of a disciplinary proceeding.
Correct.
And we've got a whole process set up here that would allow attorney to argue, you know, mitigation, aggravation, what the degree of sanction ought to be, and to raise arguments like this that weren't raised. So it looks to me like it's some sort of a collateral attack on the sanction that doesn't seem to have any jurisdictional foundation now in view of the default. Failure to appear, failure to argue, failure to raise issues. So I think you're asking us to make a legal decision which has huge ramifications for the disciplinary system. So would you tell us why we shouldn't be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, the simple way out, I suppose, is to say that there was never an appropriate objection at the disciplinary hearing. But the issue really isn't that simple in our view. It involves what happened with the attorney's fund, because the disciplinary judge says that Mr. Mulvihill is supposed to either pay Pearson, which he already did, or he should pay the fund, which he hasn't done, or do something else. So the question then becomes, in my view, whether or not we're talking about appealing what the fund did, what the presiding disciplinary judge did, or the finality of the state court order saying that Mr. Pearson has no further claims against Mr. Mulvihill.
I ask about the pleadings that led up to this hearing. I'm not exactly sure how these hearings go and what's at issue. Were you put on notice that this would include a hearing on the amount of restitution?
I mean,
the hearing that you didn't appear at, that the respondent didn't appear at.
The only notice was it was a sanctions hearing.
Okay, so it's a separate sanctions hearing, and there's nothing specified there about. I mean, what would have been your opportunity to argue about restitution or about costs?
I would have said the same thing that I'm saying here, and that is, assuming I've been there, saying Mr. Pearson has already been paid and he has dismissed all his claims against Mr. Mulvihill.
Well, that's what you said in your response to the claim.
Correct.
That was your answer to my question. Yep. But above and beyond that, you didn't do anything. You didn't. Well, perhaps you did do something, but that's what we're having a hard time figuring out. Did you say, and therefore the attorney-client fund cannot pay, doesn't have jurisdiction to pay, doesn't have the authority to pay, that these sanctions aren't warranted? And what was your argument?
Our argument was that Mr. Mulvihill and Mr. Pearson were involved in a business transaction, and that Mr. Pearson's claims involve more than just simply a personal loan and an investment in a company. It involved other business transactions, and that Mr. Pearson's responsibilities were not lived up to, so to speak, and that what had been paid in the state court was a sufficient compromise, which Mr. Pearson had agreed to. The fund didn't agree with that. And that was our position, and dispersed the $75,000. And the letter said it was the day before the sanctions hearing. The day before the sanctions order. I see my time's up, but if there's any further question, I'll be happy to answer it.
Thank you, Mr. DeLuca.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Murderer, First Assistant Regulation Counsel. I appear on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. The case concerns, setting aside the preservation issue that was addressed by the court moments ago, the case concerns the relationship between, the case is briefed, concerns the relationship between the civil proceeding between Mr. Pearson, the complaining witness, and Mr. Mulvihill, the respondent, and the attorney discipline process and the process for payment of claims by the attorney's fund for client protection. Now, with respect to the preservation issue, undeniably, Mr. Mulvihill was not there at the sanctions hearing, did not appear at any time throughout the disciplinary process, and so did not preserve these issues. I note in his brief that one of the arguments he raises is that the court somehow lacked subject matter jurisdiction, I think, to make the orders that it did. And as to that point, I would reply, as I did in our brief, simply that the rules procedure related to disciplinary process clearly bestow upon the presiding disciplinary judge the right to make restitution orders. Furthermore, I would point out that the complaint in the disciplinary case sought in the prayer for relief, among other things, restitution or payment to third parties. In fact, it was that language that the presiding disciplinary judge then put in his order. That
counsel, could I just interrupt you? So, does it happen sometimes that restitution is ordered apart and aside from the attorney-client fund?
Absolutely.
So is what makes this case odd the fact that there was a complaint for restitution, or at least a complaint for payment filed within the disciplinary case, which then kind of became the same as a restitution order?
No. I think the disciplinary proceeding here was normal.
Okay.
Was typical. I think what makes this case different is that there was at first, a civil action filed by Pearson against Mulvihill. Then Pearson filed a request for investigation with our office, which led to the formal proceedings against Mulvihill. And Pearson filed a claim with the Fund for Client Protection. And what happened was...
So we did both. So parallel things at this point.
Yes, they're parallel and somewhat independent, somewhat. So Pearson settles his civil claim before the sanctions hearing and is now arguing that somehow the presiding disciplinary judge or the people were limited in their right to request restitution because of that settlement. And the people's response is that, no, the disciplinary proceeding has absolutely different policies. It's not about adjudicating private rights and interests. It's about addressing the public policy and the public's need to protect the public and preserve the integrity of the justice system. And restitution is a recognized sanction in performing that policy and carrying out that policy.
You'd agree that restitution, even with that policy, is only to the extent that the money is owed to the victim, wouldn't you?
And so, yes, but not in a legalistic way. In other words, there was no adjudication in the civil act. There was a release, to be sure. But there was, in fact, prior to that release, a finding of default in the disciplinary case, which found that Mr. Mulvihill had done all the things that were charged in the complaint, including taking this $150,000 from Mr. Pearson. The evidence indicated that the $150,000 was owed to Pearson.
And I understand that may be an argument about the timing here and who did what and how we would know. But surely we'd start with a position, wouldn't we, that if the victim is not out that amount of money, if he hasn't lost that money, if he hasn't been deprived of that amount, then it would not be appropriate for either the PDJ to order that amount in restitution or for the protection fund to return that amount of money or to give that amount of money to the victim.
If as a factual matter, the victim had not lost the money, restitution would not be appropriate. I agree.
So then we're kind of down to arguing about, well, procedurally, how should these things get established and who should know what at what time and what should happen first, aren't we?
To some degree, and also the policies involved in the two proceedings. Not only about what happened first, but whether or not Mr. Pearson released Mr. Mulvihill in the civil proceeding, whether that release should have any effect on what we're doing in the disciplinary matter.
Well, now we're going back to the first question, and maybe we should stay with that just a second. So you're saying from the point of view of the protection fund and even the regulation of counsel that despite the fact that the victim and the respondent have made arrangements such that the victim has released the respondent and by law the respondent doesn't owe him any of that money, nevertheless the regulation system can impose that under the rubric of restitution, not a fine, not a penalty, no, not a sanction, but rather restitution.
Restitution is part of the discipline to help establish the respondent's rehabilitation. And two points. One, that's consistent with the Hunsinger case and the cases cited there, Sullivan and Hippard and Brookman. But also, look at the order in this case. This case does not enter a judgment against Mr. Mulvihill. The PDJ's order doesn't enter a judgment. The PDJ's order doesn't even require payment within a time certain. It couldn't be enforced with contempt if it wanted to. What the order requires is that should Mr. Mulvihill wish to seek readmission to the practice of law, then, as a condition of doing so, he would have to have paid Mr. Pearson or the fund, as the order says, the $75,000.
May I interrupt you on that point?
Yes.
As I read the order, there's no reference to condition of reinstatement. It's simply an outright order to pay restitution in the amount of $75,000 to Richard Scott Pearson and or the attorney's fund. I don't see it characterized here as a condition of reinstatement the way it was in, say, Hunsinger.
The order would have to be read in connection with Rule 251.29, which talks about what an attorney must do after they're disbarred. And what an attorney must do after they're disbarred is wait 8 years, take the bar exam, and then petition for readmission. And in part of that petition process, they would have to prove that they've complied with the order of discipline that was entered against them. And so reading it consistently with that rule, at that point, Mr. Mulvihill would have to show that he repaid the $75,000. As to the further issue, though, the involvement of the fund, I think that some lines have been blurred here. After the sanctions hearing, but before the order of disbarment was entered, Mr. Pearson's claim to the fund was considered by the fund in March of 2010. Now, it's awkward because the fund, we don't have a record from those proceedings. We have appendices attached to counsel's brief. And I think there has been one disagreement between counsel about the procedural posture of this case, and that is whether Mr. Mulvihill received that notice of Mr. Pearson's claim. We attached, as the first page to Appendix 2 of our brief, a letter that was sent by Regulation Counsel to Mr. Mulvihill saying, enclosed, please find the claim from Mr. Pearson to the fund. And then that letter was sent back to us. There's a receipt stamp of July 23rd, 2009, with a handwritten notation in the bottom right corner, and the copies may not be good, but essentially Mr. Mulvihill saying this isn't ready for determination because there's a civil action pending. And so Mr. Mulvihill did have notice of the claim at first. We went through the sanctions hearing, and then we submitted our report to the fund, and a contrary response was submitted through counsel for Mr. Mulvihill. Now, the fund at this point is deciding, do we pay the claim or don't we? The question is not, can we collect this back from the responsible attorney? The fund, payment by the fund is a matter of grace. And the purpose of the fund is set forth in 252, Rule
252.1. Mr. Mortimer, let me slow down for a moment, just because I want to understand where the response to report of investigation that was filed plays a role. And if I understand you correctly, Attorney Wragg is reporting back to the fund. There's been no sanctions ordered by the PDJ. And it is in response to that report to the fund that the response to report of investigation is filed. Is that correct? And that is also, of course, available to Attorney Wragg.
Yes, the response, right.
And so at the time of the sanctions hearing, subsequently, and I know I'm taking you away from your argument.
The sanctions hearing occurred before the report and the response. They occurred, the fund made their decision in March, and then the sanction was actually issued by the presiding disciplinary judge in May. And one other point, what we knew at the time the fund made its decision was that Mr. Mulvihill had defaulted, that the facts set forth in the complaint were established by law. So we knew this also. But the issue before the fund trustees was, do we pay the claim? Do we promote public confidence in the administration of justice and the integrity of the legal profession by paying this claim? We don't only pay claims because we can collect the money back. That's a nice thing if we can. But the fund's question here is, do we pay the claim? And to the extent Mr. Mulvihill now challenges the fund's decision to pay the claim under 252.13, it's a matter of grace. It's not reviewable. I think Mr. Mulvihill's real question is, hey, if the fund comes after me to collect this money and I sign a release, can I use that release as a defense? And at this point, we argued in our brief, well, that's not right. There's been no collection action commenced by the fund against Mr. Mulvihill.
May I ask, however, I'm sorry to interrupt you, sure, line of thinking here, but may I ask, what is OARC's position regarding the illegal effect of those release of claims? Does OARC have a subrogation claim against Mr. Mulvihill, and if so, on what basis?
Does the fund have a subrogation claim under this? I think that the release would likely, speaking in a hypothetical, because
I'm trying to pin you down.
The release would likely pose a major hurdle to the fund's collection against Mr. Mulvihill.
And so if it takes that position that it's uncollectible in that sense, is your argument then that's irrelevant for purposes of imposing restitution in the context of attorney discipline proceedings?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because the purpose of that restitution is to impose a sanction on the lawyer that will help protect the public by causing the lawyer to engage in conduct which rehabilitates himself. And this is the line that's set forth in, again, the Hunsinger case, the Sullivan case, the Hippard case, and the Brookman case. And that it is restitution is an accepted sanction under also the ABA standards, as we cite in the brief.
Can I follow that policy then, line of thinking? One of the things that came up in the briefing was the concern that if, from the standpoint of the fund reimbursing the client here, the idea was we want to encourage clients to go ahead and try to resolve these disputes in the civil context, right? Otherwise, they'll just throw up their hands. If they can't get reimbursement from the fund because they have settled a civil suit, then everybody would just run to the fund, right? Conversely, I'm thinking about these attorneys. What incentive do they have to settle these claims if they can turn around and get hit on the back end through a restitution order in the disciplinary proceeding?
I understand the circularity. First of all, attorneys are officer of the court, being a licensed member of the bar here in Colorado, I hope has an incentive to do what's right under the rules, regardless of the tactical advantage that may be achieved through settling or not settling. Secondly, in a disciplinary proceeding, I suppose an attorney might receive mitigation by settling a claim, paying a claim. Third, there are legitimate disputes that go on in settlement negotiations. The attorney may not have all the funds available, but will settle for what they have to pay, and will want to do that for the two reasons I just shared. But I understand the circularity, that on the one hand, the fund wants claimants to exhaust whatever remedies they have, and if we say the claimants won't get paid, they won't take it. But at the same time, this disadvantage. I think we have to just look at each case on its merits, but I think we can't be so cynical as to make policy and law on the basis of on the reasoning that, well, lawyers aren't going to do what's right.
What's the line of authority, kind of specifically? What are we thinking that permits or authorizes the PDJ to order restitution to the fund rather than to the victim and let the fund collect from the victim?
Well, the PDJ's authority to order restitution generally pursuant to 251.19, and that rule doesn't direct to whom.
Well, what is this? Horseback equity, right? Rough justice, horseback equity.
Well,
right? I mean, you don't want an extra 75,000 floating out there, right? So.
Well, I think it's a simpler answer than that. I think it's that the restitution disorder case just requires the payment again on the admission. It's not an order that can be, it's not a judgment, it's not an order that can be enforced even with contempt in this case. It's not an action to collect on behalf of the fund. Rather, it's an order from the PDJ that says, if you want to show us you're rehabilitated, pay the party that's out the money. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. The case will stand submitted.